Department when she was Florida Attorney General, the two highest level prosecutors who were investigating foreclosure fraud, the use of mass documents, fake documents in foreclosure cases that take people out of their homes, were working at the Florida Attorney General's office. And they were investigating someone who was Lender Processing Services, a key donor to Bondi. And so when she got into office, she fired those two high level prosecutors. So she has no problem doing something like that. And when she says we're going to investigate the investigators and prosecute the prosecutors, you know, this is the extension of the Trump intimidation and bullying scheme into the Justice Department. And it's the very weaponization that he decried, and her as well. So, yeah, I think it's a difficult thing.
And they kept bringing up Kash Patel, Trump's nominee for FBI, though he's supposedly independent, not clear whether any of these people will be independent from President Trump. We have 15 seconds.
Yeah, 100%. The lack of independence is what Democrats focused on in that hearing. She kind of deflected, did not give major answers on that. And so that uncertainty continues.
David Day, an executive editor of the American Prospect, will link to your article, Pam Bondi and the pay-to-play justice system, and also your writing on the L.A. fires. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
What's going on? This is Keeping It Real, and I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest is Paul Soucy of PDX ID Assistance. He helps unhoused people who've been swept by the city and lost their crucial personal documents. This month, tens of thousands of people in Los Angeles County, California, have lost their homes, their belongings, and more in a series of firestorms maximized by climate change impacts. Last fall in North Carolina, Hurricane Helene changed the topography of half the state, leaving tens of thousands of people again with nothing. What are the survivors' first steps in reclaiming their lives? Paul, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Paul, what does it mean to be swept? Can you explain or describe it?
Yeah, absolutely. So for folks experiencing homelessness, houselessness here in Portland, Oregon, some folks may have been following recent Supreme Court cases. The Supreme Court has essentially made it okay for cities and counties to declare that it's illegal to be camping on public property on sidewalks, even though there's just not enough housing here on the West Coast and here in Portland, especially. There's no housing for folks. So to be swept, the city will identify your bedroll, your tent, and post a small green poster with a date on it and with official city ordinances and citations. And then you have anywhere from 10 days to 3 days in some cases to move your property, or your property will be hauled away in a rented truck and placed in a storage facility far away from your location. And then you're expected to try to find your property again, or it will all be processed and thrown in the garbage in about 10 days. So this process is very chaotic. And for folks who are navigating the pathways from homelessness to housing, it doesn't matter if you've done all of this work to get clean and sober, to get a job, to save up for first and last in a deposit. It doesn't matter if you've got prescription medications or family keepsakes and heirlooms or your birth certificate or your citizenship paperwork or rental applications or employment applications or healthcare paperwork or parole paperwork. Like, all, think of all of the essential property that we take for granted in our housed day-to-day lives, where you take for granted that you have a secure place to store the items that are really important to you. Insurance policies, you know, medications, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I got into this because I noticed that of all of the resources that are available in Portland, it's all very piecemeal. It's all very patchwork, and nothing is addressing, nothing, no one is empowered to specifically address when you lose your ID documents.
I want to read from a social media post from Paul's stream last fall. Huge thanks to Blanchett House and Farm for mentioning my work. Now more than ever, direct and personal action to care for others is how to survive. Like most people, I'm filled with rage and grief at all the suffering we are all experiencing and seeing all around us. I'm mostly spending my own money on this project, and even so, it's cheaper than therapy for me and far better to do work like this instead of punching the people who cause so much suffering in our communities. I urge everyone to find direct and caring things that we can do to take care of one another. And I do want to say, this post came before Hurricane Helene and certainly months before the LA firestorms. You were talking about people living outside in your hometown. So, looking at your work, can you just talk about, it seems like why it's important is growing. I don't even know what to say. I talked with you about this about a year ago or so, maybe a little bit more. And we were just talking about people who have experienced poverty. And yet this is, it's growing in ways that I had not imagined. So can you just talk about that? Like, what are your thoughts about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I've been doing this work for about 3 years now. And in that time here in Oregon, we too have experienced wildfires in some of our more rural communities. And here in Portland, we've had a fair number of folks come through seeking resources, seeking assistance, trying to get back on their feet, trying to rebuild. And this is one of the obstacles that they face. They've come to us from Southern Oregon, from Talent, Oregon, and also from all over the country. Climate change is happening everywhere. Climate catastrophes are happening everywhere. We have folks coming to places like Portland and saying things like, you know, now I don't have my social security card. I don't have my birth certificate. I lost my ID. I lost proof of my, you know, documentation of my veterans benefits and of, you know, my pension documentation, my investment documentation. So they're trying to rebuild your life one step at a time when you've also just fled from an incredible catastrophe like what is happening in Los Angeles right now. We in our culture, in our larger society, are really, really good at paying attention to the latest high visibility catastrophe, the photos, the images. We're able to share that on social media and we're able to sort of take that in for about 5 seconds. We don't have, as a collective cultural practice, we don't have a good way of processing and understanding all of the nuances, all of the individual context involved. One person's situation, one person's challenges never replicate to anybody else. So every program that's out there, no matter how welcoming and inclusive it is designed to be, is always going to miss somebody, in many cases, most people. Because when you design a program to be one size fits all, what ends up happening is that it fits one person, but then everybody else is excluded for one reason or another, whether it's because of your gender identity or your ethnicity or your citizenship or your criminal record or how old you are, your sobriety, on and on and on and on. I'm focusing on IDs because it's literally about your identity. It's about who you are as an individual person. And in many cases, it's the first and most essential step before somebody can start accessing services like healthcare, like disaster relief, like their insurance benefits, like any of the things that, you know, any of us can and should take for granted. I should be able to come up to, whether it's a service provider or a trusted loved one or law enforcement, I should be able to walk up to that person and say, this is who I am. I need help. And they should be able to take me at my word. But in the culture we live in, we have to have a little piece of plastic that the DMV gives you. And then the DMV, of course, has all of the obstacles that they have. So those are the things that I'm trying to address with this project here.
Where did your idea come from in the first place?
I was a homeless shelter manager here in Portland, Oregon for 5 years before the pandemic. And so I tell people, you know, everybody has a preconception of Portland and how broken the city is. And, you know, there's some reason to that. There's some truth to that. But it's also true that before the pandemic, Portland's social services continuum, I like to say that it was like a 6-lane highway where it should have been 12 lanes, but it was 6 lanes. And to navigate, to commute that 6-lane highway from making the decision that you wanted to get housing to actually getting keys to your apartment, that commute was about 2 years on average for the folks that were experiencing homelessness before the pandemic. Pandemic happens, the highway shuts down, right? It shuts down and all of this traffic starts backing up. Folks start camping out on the streets because there are no programs left. There are no shelters left. Nobody's taking new clients. Nobody's getting into housing in those 2 to 3 years of pandemic times. Now the pandemic is quote unquote over, but only 3 lanes have reopened. So there's still all this traffic and everybody's pulling out their hair saying, where did all these people come from? The city must be on fire. But we're dealing with 5 years worth of backlogged traffic trying now to restart that journey into housing. We didn't see, even before the pandemic, we didn't see how hard it was for folks to travel that journey with all of their individual circumstances. And one of the biggest obstacles I kept seeing when I was a shelter manager was, what do you do when you've lost all of your ID documents? You may have done all of this work to get first and last in a deposit. You may have done all of this work to get a job and to get clean and sober and to reunite with your family and to organize your immigration status. But it doesn't matter if you don't have government issued ID. The rental, the property manager isn't going to take your application. And if you were born outside of Oregon, chances are you need a notary to notarize your birth certificate application. So all of this process takes time. It takes the willingness to engage with those bureaucracies. And it takes a notary oftentimes for those bureaucracies to take you seriously. And, you know, when was the last time any of us encountered a notary, right? Like, that's going to be somebody working in a bank or a law firm, and a person living in a tent on the street is not going to be able to access a notary in order to get their housing. So of course, everybody is stuck. So I'm trying to take that bull by the horns. I'm trying to address the root issues. I'm not putting any restrictions about age or gender or ethnicity or criminal records or sobriety. I'm just helping anybody who shows up to, and I pay personally, I pay for the fees. I notarize the documents as appropriate. I mail that day. I send their birth certificate application to California or to Florida or Arizona or Ohio or Maine or, you know, wherever in the country they come from. I've tried doing some international work that is even more difficult than folks born in this country, but, you know, one battle at a time. And then I pay for all of the DMV applications as well. Here in Oregon, here in Portland, folks are able to access homelessness waivers to waive the fees, but then they're treated really poorly at the DMV. They're treated very, very poorly. They throw the book at them. And you only get 2 waivers in a lifetime before you have to wait 8 years. And so it doesn't matter, like, if you've been swept 5 times, you know, and you've lost your ID 2 or 3 times, you're supposed to wait 8 years before the DMV can give you and can let you use the waiver again. So I've just been paying the fees to just get past those really petty, asinine obstacles, asinine in my opinion, obstacles that our policymakers and leadership, you know, have clearly never experienced these kinds of obstacles themselves. So they have no awareness of the impacts, what their petty restrictions do to votes, to human beings.
And you are a notary public yourself.
I hold a notary public commission here in Multnomah County, and I take it very seriously. I follow all the rules. But yes, I am a notary public here in Multnomah County.
If you just tuned in, this is Keeping It Real. I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest is Paul Soucy of PDX ID Assistance. He helps unhoused people who've been swept by the city and lost their crucial personal documents. And we'll talk more about how you can support this at the end of the hour. I want to take a minute and just dig into this. Can we list here all of the crucial documents people need after they've lost everything?
Sure. Yeah. Your first and most useful identification document is, of course, your government-issued ID, whether that's an ID card or that is a driver's license. Most state departments of motor vehicles are in charge of this particular documentation. In order to obtain an ID card or a driver's license, you're going to, again, need proofs of ID. So it's very Kafka-esque. As anyone who's ever gone to the DMV knows, you're going to go to the DMV, they're going to say, do you have a birth certificate? Do you have a passport? Do you have a social security card? A birth certificate or a passport would be enough to get you your ID card issued for the first time or replaced. You would pay a fee, whatever the fee is in your particular state. Here in Oregon, to replace an ID card is $40. To get a brand new one, if you've never had one before, is $47. To have a driver's license reissued to you, one that had been expired, you would need to get a new one, is $64. But if it was just lost, if you had had an Oregon driver's license, it was not expired, but it was lost, then it's only, I think, $36 to reissue that, the driver's license. But if you don't have your birth certificate, if you don't have your passport, they will then ask for utility bill. Okay, if you're living on the street, you're not going to get a utility bill. They're going to ask for a lease document. Again, you're not going to have a lease document. They're going to ask for, then they're going to go down the list, what I call the list of privilege, and they tend to start treating you a little more poorly. They tend to be a little more paternalistic and stern. They're going to ask for things like, do you have your food stamp card? Do you have your social security number? Do you have voter registration card? That also can be helpful in this process. They will need either one thing of ID with your picture on it. So that can be an employment identification card, can be a military ID card, or they will need two things with your full name and address and preferably your birth date on it. So that can be health insurance paperwork, that can be law enforcement paperwork, official character documentation. And as I'm sure the listener can glean from this, a lot of this depends on the personal rapport you're able to bill the bureaucrat you're interfacing with. If you can be polite and respectful, and if you can, you know, be, if you can assume best intentions of this bureaucrat, which again is hard to do, they're more likely to be kind to you and to work with you with whatever you have. I encourage people to bring whatever they have, you know, a hospital ID bracelet even could be helpful in this process. Anything that has their name on it. And again, if they have absolutely nothing, then I'd try to start with the birth certificate. But even the birth certificate often requires IDs. It's different requirements for different states. In California, I can say this. In California, your birth certificate can be replaced with a notarized application. You don't need to send a photocopy of your ID. You just need to find a notary who will notarize that you are who you say you are. You solemnly affirm or swear that you are who you say you are, and the notary can help make that happen for you. It's a $32 fee in the state of California. You have to send to the different counties, whatever county you were born in. You have to verify exactly who to make the check out to. I've learned this the hard way. I can't just say state of California. I have to say the recorder or clerk of the Los Angeles County, for example. But it's a $32 check in the state of California, and it requires a notarization. But they are very good at reissuing birth certificates. And once you have your birth certificate in hand, you can then get your ID reissued.
Because, and I know you've mentioned this before, every one of these pieces of ID has a different process. So it's like a maze.
Correct. Correct.
And you sort of have to know. It helps if you even know that. If you're just coming to this cold, you're going to have a big learning curve.
Correct. Correct. And I tell everybody to, you know, prepare for the worst, assume the best. California will take about, before the fires, California was taking about 3 weeks to reissue a birth certificate. Now, I'm assuming with what's going on right now that that's easily going to double at least. You know, I don't even know if any of those county offices were destroyed. So there's a whole, there are whole dimensions to this that are just unfolding right now. But the sooner you start this process, the better. The sooner that you, you know, try to get your ducks in a row. A lot of folks I know in a lot of preparedness, disaster kits and preparedness kits and go bags, as they call it. One of the things that people suggest is to make photocopies of all of your documentation, whether your passport, you know, your driver's license or your ID card, your social security. Make photocopies of these things, keep them in secure locations. But I would say make multiple copies in secure locations to lessen the chances of these things being lost irrevocably. Photocopies of IDs are accepted in the birth certificate process. They're not necessarily accepted at the DMV, but they can be used to help establish your identity in a DMV conversation.
Paul, I'm going to say it again. We're all watching what's happening in Los Angeles County, where firestorms have destroyed whole neighborhoods, tens of thousands of structures. It's not over yet, and we don't know how many people have been hurt. Just a few months ago, more than 150,000 homes were damaged or destroyed in North Carolina from Hurricane Helene. I myself and the home insurance industry are imagining more catastrophes are in the pipeline that will devastate people's homes and lives. There are still people who do not believe climate change is real, but insurance industry actuaries are not among those people. And you're not a climate change expert, of course not, but you're an innovator in ways to support people who have lost most, if not all, of their personal belongings. From homeless sweeps by law enforcement or natural disaster, or if Oregon is any guide, both of those things at the same time. Because a few years ago, there were two towns in Southern Oregon that were burned to the ground. And the people who lived in those two towns wound up in parking lots in Medford, the next largest town. And then the Medford police came and swept them. And so it goes on and on. From your perspective, what are these devastated communities facing in terms of the basics of getting their lives back on track? I mean, you just touched on it a little bit, but for people who don't have anything, like how can we even support them?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I would say is to any voters, decision makers, policy makers, leaders of organizations, leaders of your communities, I would urge and encourage folks to broaden your lens, widen your lens. Your life experience is incredibly important and useful. And of course you keep that front and center. But the tendency to assume that everybody is coming from the same circumstances is really dangerous and leads to a lot of the bottlenecks that we experience. We all assume, for example, everyone assumes that someone on the streets is has a criminal record or is addicted to something or is an abuser of some kind. And I just urge people to think outside of those boxes. Of course, there is some truth to those obstacles and to those stereotypes. There's some truth, but it's never the whole picture. It's always far more complicated than housed and traditionally privileged folks are able to assume. When you're coming from, for example, when you're coming from climate change catastrophe, when you're coming from a fire or a flood or a hurricane, think of all of the small pieces of your life that you really rely on and depend upon that, you know, you don't necessarily have the same place, the same importance on all of these items on a day-to-day basis. Your pets, your medication, your family heirlooms and pictures, and you know, all of these items to be lost in one fell swoop is an incredibly traumatizing event, and it puts you in an emotional space of fight or flight for the foreseeable future. So everybody standing in line is carrying that crisis with them, and any negotiation you have over water or space that night or food or information about your friends or your loved ones, right? Any conversation that you have with these folks, and I've unfortunately been on that side of the line where as a service provider, trying to gather information or trying to share information with someone, and they're not in a space to hear information rationally. They're in a space of emotional reactivity, right? Understandably so. So you really got to work on, you know, the hierarchy of needs, on like, let's start with the basics. Let's help as many people as we can. And we have to not stand on the finer points of, well, you don't have all three documentation pieces, so I can't help you, right? Like you're just 1 year over or under our age restrictions, you know, like we call it low barrier services when we try to remove. Pre-pandemic, one of the obstacles was that homeless shelters would require a tuberculosis test, as well as that you be clean and sober, as well as you be engaged with a case management. And one of the things that ended up happening was, you know, people would get on wait lists for case management, and it would be 6 to 8 months before they could even get into a homeless shelter. This was pre-pandemic here in Portland, Oregon. Those restrictions have been adjusted and in some cases waived entirely, but in other programs those restrictions still exist, and that leads to an atmosphere of distrust. A lot of folks that I've worked with over the years express that, you know, none of these service providers helped me. I see everybody else getting housed. I see everybody else getting ahead of me. That guy is a horrible person, has done terrible things, and he got into housing within 2 weeks, whereas I've been standing in line for 6 weeks and nobody's talking to me or returning my calls. I hear some version of that almost every day. And the reality is that everybody's stories are very, very complicated, and no one, not even government, has a full sense of everything that is happening with that individual. So what I also urge people to do is to let go of that perception that everybody else is getting away with something and I am the one that has the short end of the stick. That's really hard to do. Like I get that. Like I've stood in line at grocery stores and I've stood in line at the DMV and felt like, oh, that guy's getting ahead. That guy's only just got in line. Like how come they're pooping on me right now? You know, you got to focus on one thing at a time. You got to focus on what are the obstacles that you can obtain a little bit of advantage, a little bit of momentum on, and work that momentum, because it's a waste of energy, and it builds hate and it builds resentment and anger and distrust to continuously focus on everybody else who is quote unquote getting away with something. We don't know everybody's stories. We can't know everybody's stories. You don't know what that person has survived. You don't know what that person lost. You don't know whether that person was who perpetrated a terrible crime was themselves victimized at one point. We can't know. And we're not trying to solve that right now. We're just trying to solve getting you what you need right now and moving forward in your life. You know, that's the best I can manage at this time.
If you just tuned in, this is Keeping It Real, and I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest is Paul Soucy of PDX ID Assistance. He helps unhoused people who've been swept by the city and lost their crucial personal documents. And Paul, it just strikes me right now to ask you, if someone's listening to this right now, or maybe somebody's watching some of this unbelievable destruction. We watched Lahaina was completely burned to the ground, I think, on Maui.
Right.
We've just seen things that were unfathomable. How would you suggest that someone who's interested in doing what you're doing, how would they even begin?
Yeah. My dream is that every neighborhood in America has a volunteer who is focusing specifically on ID assistance, because you know your community best. You know your own, the resources that are available in your community, and every community is different, right? I know here in Portland, I'm gonna out them. I know here in Portland, don't go to the DMV on 82nd and Powell, because it's a zoo and they never treat you well, no matter how well prepared you are or how well dressed you are. You're gonna wait there for hours and they're gonna treat you poorly, right? Every community in this country has little tips and tricks like that. So instead of forming a new nonprofit, which every nonprofit in the country is going through a death spiral right now and has always been. It's never been good for nonprofits in America. Instead of forming another nonprofit, I urge people to take up the tenets of mutual aid and harm reduction, right? Keep it simple, keep it personal. Only give what you can afford to give, and you know your own finances best. You know your own resources best. What I do is I've created a separate checking account, so it's relatively secure. And I'm able to write personal checks that people can take to the DMV to replace their lost IDs. And again, I'm a notary. I became a notary here in Multnomah County 6 years ago. Every state is different, but here in Oregon, it's about $80 to become a notary, to hold your own notary commission and take the training. And then you get a rubber stamp and you get a logbook and you get to help people replace their ID documents. If every neighborhood in America had a volunteer or, someone working on helping people replace lost IDs, I don't have data. I'm not a social scientist. But I would venture to guess that the housing crisis all over this country would be significantly addressed if people could just get their ID documents and be able to apply for whatever housing is available in your community. Because again, this is the piece that I think policymakers and leaders, electeds and communities, they don't realize that. Everyone assumes that everybody has all of the natural advantages and all of the default advantages that privileged people have, and then they're squandering or they're losing those advantages, and so it must be their fault in the American meritocracy. It must be their fault that they don't have housing, but the reality is that it's these arbitrary obstacles that become exacerbated by climate catastrophe. And they become exacerbated by racism and by police brutality and by, all of the things that we live with here in America. This is how those things continue to keep somebody down if you don't have enough money and if you're a person of color or if you're a trans person or any marginalized identities. Working on your ID documentation helps to overcome this particular insidious obstacle. So yeah, every community in America, every neighborhood association in America should have a volunteer, or your church group, or your Rotary Club, whatever civic or community organization you're in with. Great. Utilize that, leverage that. And then you can help the people who are your neighbors, who you know, who you trust, and you have relationships of rapport with. You know, I'm not saying that everybody should just indiscriminately be throwing their money away and, like, you know, not have common sense about whether you feel safe helping this person. Of course not. Like, everybody gets to determine for themselves their capacity, their boundaries, right? What feels appropriate for you. But what we have right now is this paralysis because we're trusting that a nonprofit or a government agency or somebody is going to come riding in on a white horse to solve the problem for us in our community. We're gonna elect some demagogue who can make the country great again, right? I don't want to be too political, but like we're trusting somebody else. Usually the image in people's heads is a white man on a white horse is going to ride in John Wayne style and solve the problem for us. Where newsflash, we are the cavalry. We are the resource that we've been waiting for. It's not going to be a new nonprofit. It's not going to be a new political party. It's just neighbors helping neighbors.
What fascinates me about this is when you see this destruction, it's hard to imagine where to even start. And yet there are so many people who maybe don't have a lot of resources, but that's what we're kind of looking at. It just feels so hopeless. And yet there is a place to start. And there are simple ideas on how to do that.
Correct. Yeah. 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 And it's a personal scale. What I love about the ID project is that it's a tangible thing. It's a specific thing that is really essential for a lot of dimensions of your life, for going to the hospital, for getting emergency healthcare, for getting substance use resources, for education, for citizenship, for housing, for family reunification. All of these things hinge on whether you or not you have this little piece of plastic that affirms your identity, which is a really powerful thing. I am who I say I am. It's your name. It's your lineage. It's your culture. It's your heritage. That is something that everybody should feel empowered and secure it within themselves about. So that's a powerful thing to work on, and that makes this work a privilege for me.
We're talking with Paul Soucy of PDX ID Assistance, but I want to shift the frame a little bit now and talk about something a little bit different. The last time I spoke with you, you were basically producing the Iliad, which is one of the greatest pieces of dramatic literature in human history. I'm just putting that out. It's ancient. And when you told me about this, I couldn't believe it. Like, what are you talking about? This is the digital age. Why would anyone care about this? And you created a production, and you toured Oregon. You toured prisons in Oregon. But I think then maybe you even created another version of it and toured the United States and went to schools. Can you talk about that? I feel like I'm going to cry again. I love dramatic literature. First of all, what's the Iliad about?
Yeah. Homer's Iliad is about 4,000 plus years old, thereabouts. You know, nobody really knows. 3,000. This particular adaptation was written by Dennis O'Hare and Lisa Peterson. It's a script that was produced many times about 15 years ago now, a one-man show off Broadway. And this script came to me. A good friend of mine, Patrick Walsh, directed me in a production of this that originally went to prisons in Oregon in 2018, about 30 different prisons and churches and schools and community centers and theaters here in Oregon. It was, to our knowledge, it's the first play, it's the first theater piece that has been fully produced and toured to multiple prisons in Oregon in 2018. We remounted
this. And what is it
about? Thank you. The Iliad is about Oh, what is it about? It's this endless war, the Trojan War, over 10 years long. And the Iliad itself encompasses sort of a snapshot in that 10-year endless war. Achilles, Patroclus, Agamemnon, Hector, Priam, Paris, all of these heroes, uniquely actually in Western literature, there's no clear-cut villain. It is an examination of, in my interpretation, is that it's Homer was someone who was probably a soldier who had done terrible things and survived terrible things. And the Iliad is the poem that he wrote to try to recover from that experience, from the experience of war, of endless war. So it's this incredible epic poem that kind of has no beginning and no end. He describes the violence, he describes the glory, he describes the feelings of rage and longing and remorse and gratitude and tenderness and vulnerability all at once. And that's what, in my opinion, makes it so enduring, is that it is unflinching. It is unflinching in how it sees the totality of what organized violence does to the human soul and the human heart. And it's not just the men. The women have voices in this too. Andromache, Helen, Hecuba, the mother of all of these sons, she has to watch all of her sons get slaughtered in this war. Andromache has to watch her husband walk away and know that he's not coming home. And Homer somehow is able to capture the emotional truth of that, even though Homer himself, or whoever the Homers were definitely not women. And yet their humanity was able to endow them with the ability to describe this and convey this to audiences across millennia. So touring this production through prisons, the objective was to reconnect with the humanity of folks who were incarcerated, to affirm that they are human beings as we are too, that regardless of what someone has done, what they've been convicted of, what crimes they may or may not have committed, that all human beings have a right to access this culture that is our collective heritage. And that by accessing this culture, actually, it's very essential. It's essential for us on the outside to be able to connect with folks on the inside. Otherwise, the culture has no integrity. This is work that speaks to every human being. And it almost doesn't matter what the work is. What matters is the quality of that connection. So we're able to perform the play and then have a conversation with our audiences. Usually the conversation is anywhere from 30 minutes to another 2 hours, where folks are able to reflect on what they've just experienced, what they've been through by watching this play, what it brings up for them. They're able to reflect on their own humanity, on the things that they're longing for, or that they regret, or that they aspire to, the things that this brings up for them, their own cultural stories and heritages that this reawakes for them. You know, some of our most powerful audiences have been Indigenous and Native American audiences, for whom this practice of storytelling is very deep and very resonant. And getting to sit with this very Western white-coated piece of culture actually subversively reawoke their own Indigenous stories that they were then privileged to share with us. So it's this ongoing tapestry of lineage that we're trying to keep going. And then, yes, we did in October of last year, we toured this to prisons in Wisconsin, Vermont, and Maine, about 13 prisons, and then six performances on the outside in those communities. So the idea with these inside-outside performances is, if you're incarcerated, you get to see the play. And then the next day at a community church in your neighborhood, in your hometown, your mom or your loved one gets to see the play. And you get to share that communal experience together, even if you are separated by time and space. We wanted to be able to provide that opportunity for folks. And that is a, that was a really rich, is a really rich part of those conversations too. So we've received poems, we've received letters of gratitude. People have been inspired to, you know, take up their own theater programs in prisons. People are, you know, this is, again, it's a lineage. It's a tapestry of lineages of culture and performance and poetry and reflection and compassion.
Right. I listened to Dime Lo Roberts' interview with you on her Stage and Studio podcast on Oregon Arts Watch. And of course, it made me cry. And you told stories about individual people who had given you feedback at some of these productions. And I mean, can you just share one story? Like, was there Absolutely. One interaction that really stands out for you?
Yeah. There's so many, but one of the most important, powerful ones for me was actually with the corrections officer. Then this person greeted us at the door at the Cumberland County Jail in Portland, Maine. He's the lieutenant of the jail, so he's in charge of the counselors at this county jail. He's short, very stocky, former Marine, clear blue eyes like a husky, very, you know, very well groomed, very put together, very sharp, ex-military, tattoos up and down his arms. But very put together. And the first words out of his mouth, I can't tell if he's joking or not. He has this sardonic expression on his face, but he says, you know, I'm 5 years away from retirement. I'm just punching in so that I can get out. Right. Last couple of years, you know, I've been told that I have to use trauma-informed language and, I have to welcome yoga for prisoners. And, you know, at first I was really skeptical, but, you know, I'm seeing some benefits. So I guess I'm a believer now. And he says this with a deadpan expression on his face. And I can't tell if that's his way of welcoming us into the jail and saying he's on our side, or if that's his way of saying, I'm not on your side. I'm here because my orders are to let you in. Right. So then we do the show. And during the show, I see him pacing the audience back and forth. He's shushing the audience. It's a bit like a guard dog at the back of the yard. And then as the show ends, we're doing the Q&A, and a young woman in the jail, this was the women's side, a young woman, very slight, very slender, she looked to be maybe 20 years old, long dark hair. She walks up to him weeping, and I have no idea what's going on in this interaction. She walks up to him weeping, and he, you know, his face softens. He pats her on the shoulder. The body language is he's reassuring her, but I have no idea what that interaction is. Then we're walking out of the jail, and this lieutenant is checking us out. And as he's checking us out, he's tearing up. And he says, the young woman that he was talking to had been power struggling with him for weeks. She was brand new to the unit. She was terrified. Heavy things were happening in her life, and she was picking fights with everybody. And the whole time he thought, oh boy, here we go. This person's going to be a pain in my butt. You know, he thought he was going to have a rough time with this young woman for her stay in this jail. And county jail, by the way, is like limbo. Nobody knows where they're going next, what's going to happen with their charges, whether or not they're going to get bailed out, whether or not they're going to be sentenced, what their sentence is going to be for. So it's this waiting space, and it's very, very charged. So this young woman comes up to the lieutenant and says to him that she doesn't know what's happening. Play was so powerful for her. She didn't know what to say. She was having all these feelings, and that she wanted to apologize to him for being such a pill. And she didn't know what to do with all these feelings. But she was grateful. And the lieutenant said it's going to be okay, that he really appreciates and respects her for saying these things and taking accountability, and that he's got her back. And he told us at the county jail door that, like, he'd never, that had never happened to him. He had never been moved in that way. He had never seen vulnerability in the folks that he was working with in that way. So he said he has work to do now, to get right with that, you know, because his worldview, right, is being not challenged, not undermined, but that he learned something powerful that day.
Paul, look, I'm crying too. The person that you just described as Lieutenant is a character straight out of the Iliad.
This is
blowing my mind. Okay. Now, just a few more minutes about the theater, all right? Salt and Sage Theater, you've been working with them for a few years. You guys did Macbeth. Yeah. I mean, if you want to talk about, I love dramatic literature. I love ancient literature. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. And some of these classics are totally show us who we are now and always have been. Oh, what are you? Are you working on another show? What's happening with your theater?
Yeah. Oh, man, I wish I could. I can't officially share with you the project that we're working on next, because we're working on calendar, on space and production. You know, we're trying to get the productions together. But Salt and Sage is led by a Portland director, Asai Dean. She's really talented and lovely and amazing and a very, very passionate and committed artist here in Portland. And her big thing is to produce plays in repertory. So Shakespeare plays in particular, she tries to do at least two plays simultaneously with the same cast overlapping both plays.
And let me just say, theater. Salt and Sage, you've got the best theater. You've got the best actors in town. Portland used to be a theater city, and we experienced, I'm just going to say, something like a desert. And somehow in that group, you have collected the very best and brightest. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but go ahead.
No. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's very true. It's a really amazing lineup that Asai is able to put together every time. And it's a wonderful challenge for us because to learn two plays, two very different plays, usually simultaneously. Last summer we did Henry IV Part One, Henry IV Part Two, and Henry V. So if you have any Shakespeare,
these are war
the
plays. These are plays about war and leadership. Yeah. So it's weirdly current.
Yeah.
Weirdly current.
Yeah. And fathers and sons. It's about father figures and son figures and what it is to grow up and who do you leave behind and the mother figures that you leave behind. But for an actor, that is such a feast to get to play in those three plays. There are several characters that appear in all three and go through journeys over time that you don't often get to see even in a space like Ashland or any other Shakespeare festivals. You only see these plays one at a time. And rarely do you see them with the same cast. So we were able to do all three plays in succession, something like Thursday night, Henry IV Part One, Friday night, Henry IV Part Two, Saturday night, Henry V. So, you know, diligent and motivated audiences could get the whole arc in a single weekend. And that is super fun and super rare.
I just want to quickly say, if anybody is not a total theater nerd, those are all three Shakespeare plays. And they're the kind of Shakespeare plays that are not always performed because they're crunchy and they're heavy and they're very intricate. And I want to say those were not even plays that somebody paid him to do to make Queen Elizabeth look good or anything like that. You know, I don't want to be negative, and I've got some things to say about William Shakespeare. Yeah. But anyway, you can't even say what you're working on. But
I will say this. We're working on, for the first time in Salt and Sage's performance career, we're working on being able to tour whatever it is that we do next to prisons. That is our big ambition with this coming season. So that's why I'm being a little bit close with it, is because there's some puzzle pieces and chess pieces that we got to put in the right places. But the big dream is to continue what an Iliad has been doing. And what, to their credit, there are several companies in Portland that are starting to do this, several theater companies. I think of 2110 Theater with Ted Rooney. I think of Open Hearts, Open Minds with Carla Grant, Bridge Works, which does literary work in prisons. There are several Portland arts nonprofits and organizations that are working to reconnect with our friends and loved ones and neighbors who are incarcerated, the vast majority of whom are going to be returning to our communities at some point. And so we,
which is part of the point. That's part of the point. We have to stay connected, yeah. Right? And I'm just going to briefly say that just goes to show those are relations. That's relational. That's not, oh, we got a grant from so-and-so and we're going to go do a show. That's not what that is. You have to have correct. Relationships. And even the relationships with the people that run the prisons and jails is really important. And I have to jump onto a different piece now. Back to PDX ID assistance, because we're starting to run out of show. What is on the table for you right now with PDX ID assistance? Where are you going to go next?
Yeah. My big dream right now is to connect with Multnomah County libraries and use those library locations as good ways to enter into the different neighborhoods and communities. I want to recruit other volunteers who are willing to become notaries and willing to create small bank accounts that they can then write checks to the DMV or to the State Office of Vital Statistics from. To help our unhoused and impoverished neighbors, to help our folks recovering from climate change disasters, climate refugees in our city, anybody, regardless of whether you're housed or not. I know that these are expensive and often insurmountable obstacles to face on your own, but with the help of neighborhood volunteers, friends, loved ones, out of libraries, out of neighborhood associations, my dream is that every neighborhood in Portland and ultimately every neighborhood in the country has a network of volunteers who are willing to help one another. And that's what I'm going to try to do here in Portland in this next calendar year.
All right. How do people support your work?
I am not a nonprofit. I'm just a private individual, a private volunteer. I'm collecting donations through my Venmo, which is at paul-j-susi, or you can write a check to...
S-U-S-I.
Correct, S-U-S-I. Or you can write a check to Paul Susi at P.O. Box 3072, Portland, Oregon, 97208. Any amount is helpful. To give folks some context, I helped 171 people in the calendar year of 2024, and I spent about $5,900 helping 171 people replace driver's licenses, IDs, or birth certificates, sometimes both an ID and a birth certificate. Of that money, about 4,700 of that was donated by friends and family and audiences of my experimental theater work, hearing about this work and just pitching in. So I thought when I spoke to you a year ago, I said most of it was coming out of my pocket. That was true a year ago. Now, most of it is coming from friends and family who think that this is the right thing to do. So I'm super grateful and honored by that.
Paul, one more time, give us your Venmo.
My Venmo is at Paul, PAUL-J-SUSI, SUSI.
All right. And that's it for our show. This is Keeping It Real with Lisa Loving. Thanks for being with us, Paul.
Thank you so much. Real pleasure.
Find out more about what they do online on their website. It's paulsusi.wordpress.com, and that's PAULSUSI.wordpress.com. And then you can go /PDX-ID-assistance. You're listening to Keeping It Real with Lisa Loving on KBOO Portland. You can make a contribution to support programming like this at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number, 44321. Special thanks to KBOO Program Director Asia Hawthorne for making this all possible. Get involved by emailing volunteer@kboo.fm. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
KBOO. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune into KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m.